Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more. I don't know what's, inbounds and out of bounds for this conversation, given your preferences here, Chuck.
Oh, yes. I was just saying, go nuts. I think that a lot of buckaroos, very kind, are apprehensive that, there's things that I shouldn't, topics I shouldn't broach, which is so kind. Like, I do appreciate the respect of my privacy, but I am also shockingly a pretty open book. And so, yeah, I mean, you can, if there's anything I'm uncomfortable with, I won't answer, but
awesome.
Just go for it. Like, really, I am not possible to offend in that way. I think it would be pretty strange of me to present myself like this. And for the listeners, I usually wear a pink bag over my head and obscure a lot about my identity. And I think it would be kind of silly for me to get all up in arms about folks inquire. That would be very silly of me to assume that no one's going to care.
Well, so I was just going to mention that, I live in Kingston right now, but I actually grew up in Utah, and I heard that you may have grown up in Utah as well.
It is entirely possible that I may have roots there. That is that is correct. Although I don't think many are from Home of Truth, where legend has it that I originated. But I have traveled quite a bit. I spent most of my youth trotting around. Imagine like Jack Kerouac novel, but with a pink bag over the head, traveling cross country. I've been to so many dang places. I spent a lot of time just kind of wandering in my youth. So cool. It's kind of nice meeting buckaroos and they say, oh, I'm from here. And most of the time I say, oh, here's this memory I have.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
So, I first heard of you years and years ago, Chuck, I think back before I was ever on Twitter and was on forums, and you were kind of famous/infamous even then, I think, with the very iconic book covers, and especially when the political ones started coming out. And I think most of the people who know you will know quite a lot about you, but then again, Scott doesn't know that much, actually. So I wondered if we could, just as a starting point, go through some of like your early writing life and also the kind of the sad puppy stuff that exploded, because I think that's all really interesting genre history.
Oh, perfect. Yes. Yes. A little historical rundown. Okay. This is the perfect time before I jump into to just say, I am so honored to be here. I do a lot of dang podcasts, and this one, I am a huge fan. I think I've listened to every single episode, maybe some of them multiple times. When I found out that you were going to trot on some more, it is really an honor, and I am deeply moved to be here. It's very full circle, and I hope that during our conversation there are some like classic things that get to happen. Like, my dream is that I think Scott has a wonderful laugh, and so there we go, it's already happening. So I thought, I just want to make Scott laugh, and then Sumi, I really want you to tell me that it's okay, we're gonna edit that out. That is what I would love from you.
Just so you're aware, when she says that, she then does not edit anything after
I do
that,
sometimes so.
Well, I noticed, I thought, I will say, as a listener, starting off, from the beginning, that would happen so much that I thought, okay, I don't know if they're labeling their files correctly. Do I need to send a concerned email and say, listen, just so you know, the ones you're uploading are not the edits, because there's a lot of talk about how you're going to edit, and it's still in there. I think it's a very fun little trope of the pod. Anyway, I just get ready because I ramble. I apologize.
You're fine. I have to say, I'm just like honored that you know I exist, to be honest, because I think definitely in writing world, Chuck Tingle is autistic icon, which I know is not something you set out to be, but you fill the role better than Elon Musk.
Oh yeah, well thank you. It's funny because I kind of think I did set out to be that. There was a conscious point where I thought I'm going to talk about my autism more. I didn't at the beginning. I was diagnosed with what they say Asperger's, and so that is not a politically correct term anymore, and that is fine. But that is what I was diagnosed with, and the course of my life, my autism has really not been a problem for me. In fact, I think it's been very good for me. I am thankful to be autistic. I think it's super cool. I feel like I'm in the cool kids club. All my heroes are autistic. David Byrne, autistic Andy Warhol. I don't know if it's confirmed or any of these people. But so when I got my diagnosis, I was like, heck yes, this is the greatest thing ever. So excited about it. And I also then later realized that most buckaroos have the opposite reaction. It just doesn't feel good to them. And there's a lot of difficulties that come with it. You know, there's a reason that it is listed as a disability. And that's very important because there's folks that need help. And so with that, I always thought, do I really need to talk about my autism? Am I just taking up space from all these kind of more tragic stories about this? And eventually I kind of realized, you know, it's not a monolith. There's a bunch of different experiences. And along with the tragic stories, we need to kind of express the positive side of it too, and show that, you know, that diagnosis doesn't have to be this like terrible crushing weight. You know, there's another version of it. So that's kind of why I really did kind of set out and think, yeah, I would love to be an autistic icon like David Byrne was for me.
Is that David Byrne of the Talking Heads?
Yes. That was kind of my original thing.
That's like my partner's favorite band.
Oh, okay. Well, yes. Honestly, it's up there for me too. I remember seeing David Byrne on Letterman when I was a young buckaroo and thinking, wow, why is this person acting exactly like me? Why are their mannerisms the same? What's happening? And I started to do some research and I found out that he, you know, self-identified in that way. And then it just opened up a lot. And then later when I was, you know, seeing a therapist, I kind of brought it up and they said, yes, I think I agree with you there. Would you like to get an official diagnosis? And then I said, I don't know. What's the deal? And they said, well, we're going to have to check your insurance because if I give you an official diagnosis, you might lose it. You might not be able to come anymore because that'd be a pre-existing condition. So I said, no, let's not do the papers. We'll just know that it's the truth. And that speaks to another thing. The reason I like to tell that story is because the United States healthcare system and how horrific that is. I mean, that's a whole, I don't know how long we got on this pod. If you got 5 hours, we can deconstruct healthcare.
I would be happy to. I don't know if Sunny's on board with that, but yeah, it is. I mean, and a salient point there, just with current politics, though this is very much not a politics podcast. I have been very surprised how many people in my own life I have talked to that don't understand what the implications of doing away with the ACA and the protections on pre-existing conditions are. And if you say, but your family member that is covered under your plan has this, this, and this, aren't you worried about that? Oh, well, I guess, yeah, pre-existing conditions shouldn't be considered in coverage decisions then. And I'm like, but that's not what you just voted for. Like, you don't get to pick and choose once the person you voted for is in.
There's a wild ride coming our way. That is for dang sure. And actually, so, okay, politics. It's funny. Here's how much I heckin' ramble. You just asked to give a brief bio. And I will pull that back.
You are from Utah. Chuck, you are from Utah. You are not hiding that from me now.
I have the ramble.
No, the heckin'.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go. Yes. Well, so the political part, I will say, you know, so I started out, I was writing Tinglers, which are short form erotica. A lot of buckaroos kind of know me from that. I call it surrealist erotica, or even I think stylistically what I write is kind of magical realism erotica. But originally I set out because there, I would say there was a political thought behind it as a piece of art and a personal. The political is that, you know, for a very long time, conservatives, especially in old Chuck's youth, would talk about kind of how the sanctity of marriage, when they were arguing against gay marriage, they would say, what's next? Is someone going to marry a tree or two big feet or the Loch Ness Monster? And there was always this slippery slope argument. And I remember since the very beginning, I always thought, what would be wrong with that? What is actually the issue here? They would paint it as a dystopia, and I would think that's actually kind of a utopia, to let everyone love who they want, to for consenting adults to have, you know, whatever pairings they feel. And so a lot of the vision for the Tingleverse was taking that like conservative fever dream nightmare to its final conclusion and showing that actually that's kind of a utopia. It's kind of like this wonderful, sex positive, fun, funny world. So I started writing them for that. And then personally, you know, and this is related to my autism, the way that my autism shows itself is I'm very regimented. Everything is strict. If you were going to use Freud's teachings as an example, which should be taken with a huge grain of salt, but if you were, just for like the symbolism, my superego extremely overdeveloped. Everything is discipline. I would lose it over a tiny mistake. And so I started expressing myself in this way that was, okay, I'm just going to let my id out, which is the opposite of the superego. I'm going to let myself not care about those spelling mistakes. I'm going to let myself write whatever's in my heart. I'm going to put it out. I'm going to edit it once and then release it the next day, and found this method of expression by not letting myself get bogged down in those things that totally changed my life. I was, I had chronic pain. I was going to the ER. I went to so many doctors who did not know why my body was clenched so tight. I thought I would probably have to live on painkillers the rest of my life or not live at all. I mean, it was that bad. And the more that I expressed myself through Chuck, the more that pain started to go away, because that super ego that was just crushing me, which is not my autism, but I think related to the way that that manifests in me, that sort of regimented pattern discipline, for me to exercise this other part of myself, I started to relax. The pain went away. You know, it really did save my life. So I think of it, as punk rock writing. That's kind of how I see it. There's punk music, which is a little sloppy, a little fast, from the heart more than anything else. And if you do that in music, everyone says, oh wow, they don't listen to a punk song and say, oh wow, that's out of tune. You say, oh, that's a great punk rock song. You do that in writing and everyone says, oh, there's this spelling error and this needs that and that. And so I kind of hope to be pioneering, at least philosophically, the idea of sort of like punk writing.
I like that.
I guess at some point that, how do you say, I'm trying to basically lead that into like all the sad puppy stuff, because I think that was something that really exploded you.
Oh, yes. It's so funny. I feel like when I was talking, I thought, gosh, I'm talking too dang long. Let me finish this up. And I didn't even cover the dang sad puppies. Okay, so it's funny because the legend is that blew me up into the spotlight. In reality, I was kind of already pretty well known, but the legend is more fun. So I will kind of say a little of both. But in the Hugo Awards, a conservative voting bloc called either the Sad Puppies or the Rabid Puppies or both, who the heck knows? But they saw my books and picked them with the tongue-in-cheek reason of essentially saying, this is the worst art we could possibly find, that this is completely devoid of value. If you ask them, you know, or if they post about it, even today, they will say that that's not the case. They will try to kind of tongue-in-cheek, like kind of sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, and say like, oh no, that's that's not really, we really like it. They did not. They did it as a joke. They nominated me not knowing that, one, I am very sincere about my art and that there is something I think very valuable behind what I'm doing. And two, not understanding that my politics are very far left to their conservative kind of alt-right sensibilities. I kind of use that as an opportunity to speak politically on a lot of things. They started with Gamergate. So I said that if I win, Zoe Quinn, who was a target of Gamergate, would accept my award. I wrote a lot of tinglers about it and kind of spoke out against them a lot. And that was, I think, an origin story for a lot of Buckaroo.
I guess I wanted to kind of start with like all of that context, because you have, you know, for someone who's ended up in trad publishing or hybrid publishing, I guess you do have a really long and unusual journey and really interesting. And well, I'm going to get into something else in a second, but I guess the first thing I want to say is, you know, I read, oh shoot, what was it called? Not Bury Your Gaze, the first one.
Camp Damascus?
Camp Damascus.
Yes, Camp Damascus, when it came out. And just while I get the chance, you know, I remember reading it and feeling really struck by the total kind of oppressive mind fuck. And that for me was captured really well. And I really did enjoy that book on lots of different levels. But yeah, so anyway, I was going through all that context first, and I'm rambling now too. But the reason for that is because I remember you saying to me when we were chatting a bit on Blue Sky that you kind of disagreed with a lot of what we have to say. And I'm really fascinated to hear that.
I can't wait. Well, I should preface this with saying that this show is amazing. I am so, so honored to be here. And I think that what you are doing is, it's an interesting situation because it is so, your audience is so limited, right? Like, yeah. I mean, you know, you've posted publicly about, you know, are we going to keep doing this? But I'm so dang glad that you are. But you deserve so much credit because by the nature of this show, it can never be, you know, and not, you know, it's not going to be Joe Rogan, not that you would want to be, whatever huge podcast you can think of, simply because the audience is very, very small. It is specifically for people who are kind of like entering traditional publishing, trying to break in, or just, I guess you do kind of self-publishing stuff too, but it really is kind of like the traditional publishing journey, of which there is almost no information. So I want to start by saying that I think what you are doing is like this outrageously public service, and I have endless gratitude for this show because you are putting in all this effort for something that is just helping this small amount, but an amount that has no help. There is really no information about this. So for someone like old Chuck, despite coming from a very different background, I think that it was helpful even for me. And I just want you to know how many Buckaroos you are helping. So that's my premise. That's me talking you up. My compliment sandwich, if you will. and it's not even a, it's not even a, I mean, this is not even the aggressive middle. I would just say that upon listening to your show, what is fascinating to me is that we are all kind of on the same journey, and that my experience could not be more different. I think that our journey through publishing has been complete opposites in a lot of ways, as far as kind of like the way that maybe we feel the industry works, different things like that. I mean, we can just go through, but the amount of times that something will happen on the show and I just think that is literally the opposite of my situation. And I think it speaks to the show in that I still love it. You know what I mean? But where can we even... Oh, I know where we can start. I'm sorry. You know what? You ask the big question. I was going to go on a tangent. You ask the dang questions.
What I'd like to hear, Chuck, is, well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. And I hope people know how much work Sunyi has put into this in particular. And she's going to get very embarrassed about this, but she is a remarkably altruistic person. In a way that
that's not
I necessarily am not.
No, you gotta keep it in, Sunyi. You gotta keep it in because that's the word I was looking for. It is you are doing a service that is an altruistic service with this podcast. Absolutely.
That is very kind of you, and I do appreciate it genuinely. But I also feel compelled to say that I feel like it isn't really altruistic, because even if it has benefited other people, I'm not sure that was ever the goal. It was more like we just wanted to get it out our system and have these kind of chats for our own sake, you know, whether it was kind of a good idea for Scott's career or not. And we didn't necessarily think too much about the consequences. But anyway, yeah, thank you.
So anyway, sorry, Chuck, the question for you, my buckaroo, is how did you get into trad? So I know about the Tinglers, at least, you know, on a superficial level, I've known about you and of you. But then when your trad books started coming out, I thought, oh, hey, that's cool. That's interesting. That looks like, you know, so how did that transition happen? You know, what were the connections that were made that led to that?
Yes, very different path right off the gate. This is a great starting point. So I and not only trad but Macmillan, so Big Five trad. Okay. I guess when people are talking about indie publishing, do they say trad? I don't even know this, you know, is that like...
We're usually referring to Big Five or Big
Okay,
Five.
Okay. Yes, yeah. This is how I'm such an... I will say I am a complete outsider to this. I did not go to English school. I do wear this mask, but you know, I am not familiar with the writing industry. So I come in completely outside. And when I first started out, you know, I had these Tinglers. I had a large fan base. I wrote a novella called Straight that was kind of me doing queer horror for the first time, just because I've always loved horror. And I was like, okay, will the audience like this? And everyone loved it. Straight did very, very well. So then I just sat down. I had this idea for Camp Damascus and I wrote it. So I wrote this novel and then I went on Twitter and I posted, I have written a full horror novel. Would anyone like to publish it? And then Macmillan Tor commented, yes, we would. So that is how I got my publishing deal.
The Tor Twitter account?
I think so. Or that? Nightfire. Yeah. Yes. What? Either Tor or Nightfire. Because I'm on Nightfire, which is all, yeah, it's all the same. Yeah. It's like the horror division of Tor. So I just tweeted. I tweeted, I would like big, I said, I think I said, I would like a big traditional publishing deal. And then they said, okay. So then I got this dang email. They said, send it over. I sent it. They loved it. They said, we really want to publish this. Do you have an agent? I said, no. So then I went and got myself an agent. And the rest is history. Then we signed a 2-book deal, Camp Damascus and something else, with an option for 3. And now that I have done Camp Damascus and Barry Grays, then we just negotiated another 4-book deal. And I stuck with Nightfire. So I just signed a 4-book deal with them. And so that is kind of the process. And I think that's kind of the short, silly version. You could say, oh, Chuck just tweeted, which is technically true, but also you could also say, you know, Chuck spent, you know, 6 years self-publishing, building a massive social media following, mm-hmm. and then leveraging that into a deal. They're both unique stories. One is certainly funnier than the other. I don't know which one is kind of, you know, the most realistic one, but I think that ties into the first big thing I think that I disagree on with not just people who come on this show or these wonderful hosts, but I think most artists really do not like the fact that they are expected to be more than an author. I think that most buckaroos and pretty much everyone who comes on is very upset by the fact that they need to have a social media, they do all this stuff. And I would argue, as an artist, we are always more than the text of our book. We are always the story going on outside of it. And that what a big corporation like Macmillan is actually buying is not necessarily the text of the book. It's not what's in between the pages. It is the story around it. You could say that it's, you know, what you had for breakfast on the way to writing your book, what you how you felt, your life circumstances, all these things. But really what they want is something that someone will pick up the book and buy, not just because of the text that's on the page, but because of everything else. And so I kind of tend to think that many think of that as branding and go, yuck, I don't want anything to do with that. I think of it as part of the art. I think of everything that we do is a giant artistic expression, and that the real art is not writing the book, but the multimedia experience between the author and the reader of what it is to pick up your book. What is the gift you are giving? I can extrapolate on that a lot, but that I think that's the first big thing that I think I differ on.
I would love to go into this.
Yes.
I kind of agree with that, but I also just think that I can't do it.
I do and I don't. Like, so I'm going to ask you this, both of you.
Go for
it. Can you name three other people that you read regularly because of their social media or their online presence?
Yes, but I think that I would expand it farther than that. Okay. I think, well, first of all, I would say that another thing that I'll get into, and that I think it's important to admit, because I think everyone comes to art in different ways, and I am an outside artist, I don't read very much. I read almost all, like very little at all. I kind of only read to give Buckaroo's blurbs. So it is a little harder for me, but I would say that social media is this new invention, only a couple of years old. What I'm talking about, and what I would rephrase that is can you name three people that what you know about them frames the way that you enjoy their art and why you pick it up? Because social media is the newer version of this. So for instance, if you went to the library and you saw Huckleberry Finn sitting there and had never heard, who is this Mark Twain person? What do they represent in American literature and stuff? I don't think that you would necessarily pick it up. I mean, you wouldn't even know about it. You'd say, here's one of 10,000 books. But we have this sort of story, and the art of who Mark Twain is about the legend of Mark Twain. That is a wonderful story, but there's all this extra context that we bring from life. I would say not only can I name three, I would argue that literally every single writer you have ever read, bring to that art something that is outside of the art, and that the ones who find financial success are the ones who have managed to somehow like leverage that. I mean, off the top of my head, because I will try to like directly answer it, I would say someone like Anthony Bourdain, great example. I love Kitchen Confidential, and I only read that because I know his personality. I think, sure, who is this, you know, this person? I would say someone, and this is kind of stretching the meaning of it a little bit, but even someone like Edgar Allan Poe, who, you know, it's, I read that and it's so, I would say that it is relating in the ways that I'm not necessarily scared, but the mood of it, who he was, knowing his biography, makes it much creepier when you actually think that this thing. So, you know, it's things like that. And I think that as a up and coming writer, what I would encourage Buckaroos to do is to think, if I'm going to a publisher with my book, not only how good is my book, because we should still write the best book that we can, but think, what is my story? Like, what is it that I'm giving them that is not the same as these thousand things? Because I truly believe every single person, alive or dead, has a completely unique story that is, if framed the right way, and if presented the right way, and if they can pull it out of themselves, worth attention of everyone. We have beautiful stories that we all have.
So, I mean, we've talked a bit about in the past about how there's like the kind of three types of reader or writer, like the communer, the projector, the escapist, and that a lot of people, like if you read to see yourself in fiction, that's different from people who read to just get away from their life. And that's different from people who commune with the creator through the art. I'm definitely a communer. So I do gain value from, like, for me, it's part of the joy of reading Gene Wolfe is finding out about this man. You know, every book is like a puzzle. It's like you're unlocking this puzzle and you're engaged in this little game with him. But I wouldn't have read about him first and then gone to his books, I suppose. But I guess the other thing is that, like, while I enjoy that communing aspect with readers, I have never felt social media was the best place for me personally to do it, because it just triggers like that kind of rejection sense of dysphoria when people are nasty online, and I don't cope with that well at all.
Oh yes. Well, and I think that's fair. I think that I would not want to be misconstrued in thinking that what I'm saying is that everyone needs their social media. You know, it's really not like that. It's more a recognition of the idea that we all as artists want our art, whether you are a painter or a musician or a writer, we want our art to kind of exist in this sort of science lab where the world around it has no effect on how it's perceived. And that just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And so
not anymore.
Certainly not anymore. And I would say too, that if you really start getting like really sit in that for a while, you'll realize it kind of never did, because even knowing nothing about an author is something. It does bring another tone to it. I mean, look at me. Granted, I have other things, but no one knows my legal identity, right? So if you did, people would be interacting with my art in a completely different way. And so all that I encourage, you know, if it's not social media, that's fine. Maybe it's the opposite. Maybe it's that you submit this and they try to look up anything about you and you've never existed on any government database. You know, there's other things, but it's just what these companies are looking for, because I think what they've realized is that they are essentially selling a story. And we all have a story, and that story is not necessarily the book we wrote. Okay. And I think that a lot of folks find that very disheartening, and I understand that. It's a lot to take in, but I think once you kind of accept that, you can start to think, well, what is my story? And I think everyone has a pretty amazing story. You can get creative with it. It doesn't have to be social media. It's something we haven't even thought of.
Yeah. And I want to clarify why I asked that. And I want to clarify that I don't disagree, right? I think what you're describing is a very valid path, and it's obviously worked for quite a few people. And whether that quote unquote brand comes from the work or comes before the work, in somebody's path, I don't know that it necessarily matters, because what you're saying is absolutely correct. I mean, obviously your story is unique for various reasons, but I don't think the path is very different from, for example, the several other indies that have been picked up by Tor Nightfire in the last several years, right? Like I could name a few who were picked up because they had gained a following, mostly with their work, but they had gained a following as an indie, and then Tor picked them up and blasted it into the trad world. And as far as I can tell, very successfully, right? And so that's awesome. Yes. That's a great path. What I would argue you may not appreciate just from, you know, our conversation here is how unique you are and how unique you put into the world is, and how compelling it is compared to what maybe even another excellent writer could produce. You know, I think that if you are going to try to prescribe, which is a mistake in and of itself, but try to prescribe a path to success, that is it difficult for most people to achieve.
Oh, yes. Yes. No, I agree with that. I am fully aware of how unique my situation is. Yes. It is a one in 100 billion. It is so, so earth-shatteringly rare. That being said, I do think that there are other versions of how rare what I did are that can be discovered. And the reason I can't give examples is simply because they haven't been discovered yet. My path came about in this very, very strange way that I do not think people should try to repeat, because they won't be able to do it. But I do think that they have another version. I will also say that I think that, you know, I similar to what you said, and to agree with it, It's almost like a survivor bias. It's like, of course, Taylor Swift goes out there and tells you anyone can be in my position. And that is not the case.
Just write your songs and you'll be massively successful.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
That's worked for everyone.
So I do not. I definitely don't want folks to come away thinking that is what I am saying.
Sure.
It is really just a sort of an acknowledgement, I think, of, and what is most important to me out of all these points is not necessarily, doesn't have anything to do with the rarity of my situation, because it is incredibly rare. What I would hope folks get away take away from it is the fact that when you submit that book, the book itself, like the story of a book being so good that it is just undeniable and becomes a bestseller simply because it is so good, while that happens, is about the rarest story you could think. It's rarer than mine.
That's true too.
And
I agree.
And they are all rare stories, but that kind of the least, the more most plausible, despite being million to one and not 10 billion to one, but the most plausible is to come to these large companies with a story that is more than your book, with
Absolutely.
Something, whether it is your social media presence or whether it is your lack of it, or whether it is, hi, I wrote this and I'm going to write 50 books over the next 50 years of my life, and it's going to be one for every state. I just thought of that because that's what Sufjan Stevens did and kind of how Sufjan Stevens blew up. But you can come with something that is outside of that, that is part of your art, and that suffocating feeling of, oh, this is branding. I think that no matter how much we get upset by it, it just won't go away as we live in this horrific capitalist hellscape. Yeah. There's a way to kind of integrate it into your art.
Yeah. And I think what you choose to write and the authenticity with which you can write that matters a ton, right? Like Sun Yi's debut is, at least my read on it, right, was deeply about parenthood and motherhood and growing up. I don't know, Sun Yi, stop me if I'm saying anything embarrassing, but you know, being raised in an oppressive way in various ways, right? And the corollaries to the real world are very poignant because she can write those things with authenticity, right?
I think for me it was about the realization I had as an adult that just because I couldn't imagine things didn't mean they couldn't happen.
Yeah.
Which is a thing I think people run into a lot. You know, a lot of people be like, I can't imagine what my life would look like if I quit this job I hate and, you know, chase something.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. That's very abstract.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and this doesn't necessarily need to go into the final edit, Sun Yi, but Chuck, you may appreciate this if you did, in fact, grow up in or around Utah. I mean, that's one big reason why I'll keep writing sci-fi and fantasy, and people will see more from me in that space. But that's why I chose to make my next work and what I'm going to try to sell next something that is, I think, at least somewhat unique to me and my perspective and how I grew up, et cetera. It's, I guess, maybe expose is too strong of a word, but an exploration of the true story around the founding of Mormonism, because a big part of my life was, you know, growing up Mormon and then learning that real history and being absolutely blown away by it. You know, that I think ties into exactly what you're saying. And
oh, yes, 100%
to me. Yeah,
that is 100%. Like, I have my camera off right now for those listeners. I am like almost moved to tears hearing that. That is 100% what I'm saying. And it's like, there is a power and like a radiance beyond our understanding when we let the art, like when we stop pretending that it's in this science lab, when we say, no, it has its tendrils in every part of my life. And this is going to connect to, you know, when you bring that up, it's so easy to think like, oh, I feel weird about about this because am I using this important thing in my branding? And I feel like that has been beaten into us so much that we shouldn't kind of advocate for our stories, when in reality, it's like, no, that is your art. That is like the kernel that we've been trying to drag out of ourselves since we picked up a pen. That's the point of all of this. And I don't know what it is that has beaten down artists into thinking like, no, like you can't let it spill into these other things. That's disingenuous too. So anyway, I am so moved by hearing it. I think that's wonderful. Like, I'm not exaggerating. I am deeply moved by that. I think that's such a great, cool thing that you're doing.
Can I ask a quick question? And this might actually be something we have to edit out depending on how I phrase it. So what do we think about authors and... For example, Brandon Sanderson is probably the iconic one, I think, that comes to mind. That for me, part of what makes him successful is his ability to not show himself. And I hope that doesn't sound horrible, but like, I'm pretty confident that behind closed doors, he's a fairly standard, right-leaning, conservative Mormon guy, socially conservative. And I think he's very aware that that's like a career death sentence.
Oh, interesting. Well, that I think that dichotomy and that tension that you're talking about, that is sometimes this thing where I'm talking about like the art and stuff, we can't really control what it is. And sometimes it's negative. Like sometimes it is kind of a scary thing. I mean, the safest version that I think most can agree on is someone like J.K. Rowling, where it's like, look at how much the person has affected how we interact with the art. Now, you know, that for me makes me not want to like it. Like this power of appreciating the way that the art connects to the world doesn't always have to be positive. As far as Sanderson goes, I will say I have always asked whenever I trot to I don't read his books, but when I trot to like events or folks that know him, I remember saying once, out of curiosity, is he a good hang? And every single person that I have asked says great hang. So I don't know. I don't know how much truth there is, but everyone says great hang. So I think it'd be fun to party in that way and see what happens. I don't know. But I think that not all the time. I don't think it's always a good thing. I think that it's just this endless story that we're constantly writing, and that's the way the art goes.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm not in any way slagging him off. He seems like a really nice person. I've heard that he's really quite genuine and quite kind. It was more just a comment that our industry does lean politically and socially quite far to the left. So I think, you know, there is an element where he's maybe feels he has to be cautious, because even for those of us who are are very socially and politically left, we still have to be cautious. But yeah.
I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because I talk enough shit about Mormons and Mormonism and we talk enough shit about conservatives that it's worth bringing up that I think there is a problem in this industry in particular, being able to treat people as an entire person and accepting the good with the bad, or maybe not even bad, the things that we disagree with, right? Because I think there are a whole lot of people, and I'm guilty of it as much as anybody, willing to write off and quote unquote cancel for what may be reasons beyond somebody's immediate control, even if those are personality and belief type reasons.
Sure. Yes. Well, I think honestly, my relationship with that, honestly, is I think that too often buckaroos try to kind of like create like a one sentence rule about what art they are or are not going to interact with, and then try to implement that on others. Whereas I see it as a personal choice, and I do think that, you know, that is fair, that's okay. I think that a lot of what folks kind of like say is canceling or something like that, I don't even really believe in it, because to me it's just like a choice of admitting what I just said, which is, so J.K. Rowling, perfect example. folks, you know, talk about separating the artist from the artist. If you really believe what I just said about the story being outside of the book, there is no separating it. And yeah. And really what it comes down to is more, does it make me feel the way that it used to feel to interact sure. with this art? And it doesn't. So I don't purchase yeah. it. You know what I mean? If yep. it makes me feel so bad that I feel bad about other people who read it, then that is, I guess, a fair artistic, you know, interaction too. But I still think that those are like steps of personal choices of, yeah. you know, did this person say something I didn't like, or is this person, you know, like a sexual predator, or all these, yeah. these different things yeah. that are all yeah. various levels that are all going to depend on the person. And really, I don't even see it as like a conscious choice to like yeah. not do it. I think the thing that I always think of is like when, if I say, oh, I'm not going to, you know, what's an example? If I say, I'm not going to listen to a Chris Brown album and people okay. say, oh, well, you know, are you just not getting that because of the things he, you know, you got to separate that. I think, no, I just don't want to listen to it. It doesn't make me feel good because I know what happened. You yeah. know, I always think like, what do you want me to do? Buy the album I don't like? Buy the yeah. book I don't like? What is this? So yeah. I don't know yeah. how many people are getting canceled as much as people don't like what they're creating because the story outside of the book is no longer pleasant to them.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm certainly not advocating that we need to, especially on a personal level, need to accept everybody for who they are, no matter who they are, right? Like J.K. Rowling's, I completely understand and sympathize with how the things she said really hurt people, right? And I was more aiming those comments at my own, I've had people ask how I feel about Sanderson and others, given my personal vendetta yes. with Mormonism. But I mean, I've had to have conversations recently about Trump nominations. So Gates is the latest one, and about how I believe that his personal conduct absolutely makes him an unacceptable candidate for Attorney General. And I've had some people say, well, if he did this thing wrong in his personal life, does that mean he's not going to be a good lawyer, a good attorney general? And my answer is absolutely yes. I don't get yes. rid of that guy. He should absolutely be canceled.
Yes. And that interaction is the same as I think that we've really had beaten into our heads that we can't do that with like a painting or something. Yeah. And the truth is you can. It's just, you know, you don't have to make a rule about it. You don't have yeah. to say every yeah. single person who's done that, you yeah. know, or you sure. can just look at it and say, you know what, I'm going to, you know, there are other artists, because I mentioned Chris Brown for musicians, where it's like, okay, I understand their story and I will still listen to them, but I'm not going to name them on a podcast or something. Yeah. It's like yeah. we each get to kind of like say how much we're going to promote, yeah. how much we're not, and how much we're sure. going to interact with. And that's fine. It kind of works itself out that way.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Can I just say, yeah. I am loving this, and I feel like either, we're going to do like a two-parter epic episode, or I'm never getting invited back.
If anybody's getting invited back, it's you, Chuck.
There we go.
I won't go into all this, every single author, but I think, you know, definitely as you hear stuff come out, like I remember I loved Hyperion at university. It was like a landmark mm-hmm. read in my life. And then I think it was in recent years that Dan Simmons kind of revealed himself to be an unhinged, autism-hating sort of loony. And I was a bit like, still like the book. It just, you know, it puts me off other things he's written.
Oh, no. I didn't know that. I'm literally looking at a copy of The Terror right now. And the way I look at it before my eyes has shifted. It's like the saturation has gone out of the room.
Yeah. Yeah, my version of that is David Eddings. His books were the first fantasy I ever read. And then I found out much later in life that he had some shit in his personal history. But I mean, that we could go even deeper into that, but I won't.
I had to explain that to my partner about locking children in basements yes. and tormenting them. It's like,
oh my goodness.
Well, wow. So the interesting thing is, yes, that is accurate. So he and his, and I may get some of these details wrong, but he and his wife adopted some kids, and their method of discipline was locking them in a basement, I guess. And they were actually convicted and served time for child abuse for it, right?
Oh,
so obviously horrible, horrible. But I also read an academic article about this situation and whether we can read monsters, right? And I guess I can send you a link, Sunny, if I can find that article. But the whole point of the article was, yes, David and Leigh Eddings did horrible things, and they, you know, they were convicted. It's not a question. They did horrible things. But the article went into how that's how David Eddings grew up, and he was subjected to even worse than that as a kid, and apparently had written the Belgariad and some of those books as kind of an attempt at self-redemption and kind of an exploration of how a better way of growing up might be. And maybe some of the shit, you know, the awful shit snuck into that and tainted it. But I thought the question, you know, there's so much nuance when you get into art versus a person and what that art was to that person and whether that person was a shit person and still remained a shit person or attempted their own sort of redemption arc, et cetera.
Yes.
But anyway, yeah, complicated.
And I think it's very different. Like, everyone's got different thresholds, different things trigger them. Like, I remember I stopped reading Orson Scott Card because he is kind of a douche. But also the book that I kind of threw at the wall, I can't even remember. He has like a series about like a drunken Indian man, he calls him, and like this white savior kid. And it was just like the most atrocious. So that for me, that was like not just the author, but like his books had actually become like the worst kind of propaganda.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, the book itself, the art itself changes. Art is not static. Everyone wants to think that it's frozen in time, but it's not. Yeah. It interacts with time. It is always changing. And it is, to use the word, you know, it is so intricate, and I would argue that I try to reframe it as, you know, what you said is the article is, can we read it? And I kind of reject that. I think what it is a question that we pose to ourselves of, can I read it? And that's kind of all that matters. Mm-hmm. And that's going to vary for each person. And you know, I think that when you start saying, can we, not you saying it, but these articles, and that's generally how it's framed, you kind of take it's a rejection of the responsibility that you have as part of this multimedia project, where no, it's going to be your decision. If you want to read that and support that, then you're going to have to deal with that, and that's fine. But it's not about what we do. It's about what you do, you know? Anyway, wow. This is a blast. Gosh, I feel like we've gone on this journey and we're so close, and I'm going to blow it apart because this does remind me of it. This reminds me of the second big disagreement number two looming above us. I will present it like this. So I have a mask, as we have covered for the listeners, and you know, my legal identity is hidden. But I've spoken before about the fact that I am a known, in some ways, creative buckaroo. I will say I've been a creative my whole life. I have never had like a day job, because as a young buckaroo, I entered creative fields. And I will say that I have been to the heights of, you know, whatever we call the big publishing deal on a big five. I have done that in other industries. Use your imagination for, you know, the big film studio, the art museum, the Michelin star restaurant, the big record deal, whatever you want to think of it, the equatable in a different art form.
Actually, Taylor Swift, aren't you?
Yes, there you go. And I will say, book publishing, by far the best, by far the fairest, and the kindest to the artists, unlike anything I have ever seen. You compare it to these other big systems. I'm just going to throw out, for example, something like the Hollywood system and the way that folks are treated with contracts, the way that all of this stuff goes. When you sign a book deal, in any other art form that I do have personal experience in, publishing, it is the people working in publishing care about the actual art over the dollar, not entirely, way more than any other industry I've seen. It is shocking. And so I do feel like, you know, it is easy to get down on some of the things that happen in this industry. But I guess the big, you know, bomb I'm lobbing into the mix, I actually think it's pretty dang good compared to what I have seen across other mediums.
No, I do actually agree with that because, I mean, I think we talked about it a little bit with D.V. Bishop about how TV writing is much worse and more cutthroat and and acting and like comedy is like fucking brutal. I'm not a comedian, but I like comedy a lot and follow kind of, you know, some comedians as their pitfalls and stuff. But I think for me, the main difference I encounter is expectation that for some reason, like most people who go into film, they know that it's brutal. They, you know, people have a general awareness that if you're trying to be an actor, it's going to be a gauntlet. I think most people have an awareness that it's tough to try and break into music. But for some reason, everyone thinks that publishing is different, which is really odd.
Oh, that's interesting. You know what? I've been personally kind of trying to figure out the why of all this. And I have a couple of theories. That's an interesting take, is that kind of the legend of what it is to be a published author, the bar on the legend is like set lower in our minds of like when in reality, I think there's some statistic. It's like you're more likely to be in the United States, if you go with like the census or whatever jobs, you're more likely to be a professional athlete than a published author. It's like just this amazingly difficult thing to do. My theory, honestly, there's a couple of things because I was trying to parse this out, why it seems to be more art focused. The obvious top version is that I'm just lucky, but I do think that, you know, it seems like at Tor specifically, like there is a sort of genuine like interest in like what is a, you know, they're like fans of the genre almost in a legit way that like someone at a studio is like, oh, I'm producing this horror movie and I, you know, don't care about horror, but what are the numbers? So I do think that kind of at least Tor seems to have that going for it in a positive way. I think that the book industry is older than all these other industries. It's like by hundreds of years. So maybe some of the kinks have worked out. I think that it could be the fact that a lot of the buckaroos in it aren't paid that well. So they like don't have the sort of, they kind of have to be there if they love it. I really don't know. But there is something going on in the industry that is just, I mean, there's the saying, what is it? In Hollywood, it is yes until it's no, which is in Hollywood, everyone says yes. And then in publishing, it is no until it's yes. And I have found that to be absolutely true. If someone says, oh yeah, we're going to sign this deal, and you wait and wait and you don't have those papers and you're like, what the heck is happening? It always comes. I'll tell you, in something like Hollywood, you're going to have 10 people who say yes, and all of them don't actually happen. It is weird in that way.
I would like to clarify personally that even given my experience, right, that we've gone over ad nauseum on the pod, I have encountered far more genuinely wonderful, intelligent, awesome people at Tor and in the industry generally. And I do mostly share your enthusiasm for the people that we get to interact with, right? And I can't really comment on Hollywood or any other artistic creative industry. I came from corporate and tech and engineering, and I'm very sympathetic to the business side of publishing needing to make money, et cetera, et cetera. Where I grow frustrated and was personally frustrated, and it, thank God, is not the case anymore. I believe strongly that people's experience in this industry depends heavily on their editor, and not just on a good, bad scale with an editor, but fit with an editor, right? So that's everything from artistic compatibility, communication style, et cetera, right? So yeah, it's highly variable. And I think on the subject of why is publishing better than other industries, I do think you hit on something with, well, A, people being lower paid, but the turnover and the power structure such as it is in publishing, I think is more accessible to people who care about art, who care about other people making art, than it might be in other industries. It seems like the power structure in Hollywood, for example, is very concentrated, stays with the same people for a very long time, and they get to act like assholes and not have accountability because they are rich as fuck and they have all of these people they're connected to. And I think that does exist in publishing to some degree, but you have a whole lot of editors who get to make quite a few decisions who are in publishing for the right reasons. And I just don't think that exists in Hollywood.
Yes. In, you know, when you said that, you triggered something like it could also be just as an art form, because books take so long to read that it's not like, you know, if you're at a record label, you can say, oh, you know, I listened to that. It took me 2 minutes and I decided I don't like that song. You know, but you have to read an entire book. You better care about writing. If you're going to be in the book industry, you better care. Whereas a lot of these other things, even watching a 2-hour film, you know, that doesn't necessarily have to be someone who loves films. That can just be someone who, you know, got their business degree and then got a bunch of promotions from in and, you know, ended up somewhere where they're choosing things about films, but certainly not a fan of them. Whereas I don't think anyone's going to be reading all these books unless there's something within them that cares about that.
Yeah, hard agree. Yep.
I do think author expectations are a big factor just in my anecdotal experience because you know, you never get actors who are like, oh God, the director told me how to do the character in a certain way. But like there's a kind of understanding that the art they're making through film is collaborative and is informed by different cooks in the kitchen. Whereas, you know, I think the last time I was at someone's 50th birthday party a few months ago and my non-writing friends, they were like, oh no, don't you find it really hard to like, you don't get to have your book exactly the way you want and editor has input. And it's like, no, because it's still really creative. Like it's still...
Yes.
What other job would you have any kind of scope? But I think authors are very protective of their work sometimes. And sometimes people do react badly to being told
interesting.
This is collaborative.
Yes. Well, and, it is in, you are right in that it is in the rare medium where it is essentially one person making every creative, even in music, it is generally, you know, like a 4-person band and a producer or the record label or in film, you know, it's an entire, you know, 100-person crew, you know? So in, I can understand where in writing someone would write every single word and turn it over to an editor and think, wait a minute, they want me to change, you know, what ends up being 5% of my book. And it's like, wow, do you realize what it would be like to be the one actor in a film of 20 other actors who are all part of that art? So yeah, I think you're right. It has a lot to do with the fact that the author is making the whole thing. It's such a precious baby.
The other thing I wanted to comment on where I do think the industry generally, and I don't know exactly who the person is in each publishing company to point at, but where I do think the publishing industry is culpable is something you yourself mentioned at the very beginning of this podcast, which is there is not information available, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
Especially for people who did not come into their publishing career with some sort of brand or platform or a large deal that the publisher is going to have to work hard to earn back. Understanding the decisions you're making in your personal life associated with that creative dream and what you think slash hope will be a career, right, is difficult because not only is there not information available at times, the information you are given or expected to act on is bad and purposefully bad.
Oh, wow. Yes. I mean, that is, it is true. It is a real black hole of information, isn't it? It's, yeah. It is fascinating. And you know, I guess getting with a good agent can help, but even then I feel like a lot of buckaroos starting out, feel like they don't want to bother their agent, or they're like sneaking around, or like, are they going to drop me? 'Cause I wrote them 2 emails in a week. There is a fear there that I do think, I mean, I will say, I have way too much confidence. Maybe not too much because it has served me well. But still, even me going into it when we signed the Camp Damascus deal, I there, you know, just the first few months alone, when you're kind of waiting on the difference between like kind of the deal points and the actual paperwork, they don't tell you that that's going to be like 5 months. It is so long that I feel like most authors would just lose their mind in that part of the process. It's the first thing you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do want to mention on the topic of agents, since you brought it up, I you're right. You know, an agent can help guide a career and set expectations, et cetera. But I do think a lot of agents have acclimated to the industry being what it is, and publishing careers not necessarily being a viable career, right? And some of them view, and I think many authors even would agree with this, some of them view their job is to get the best deal possible and not necessarily to make sure that each deal is a livable wage, for example.
Oh, sure. Yes. Well, my advice that I would give, and I give to the listeners on this across any art form, which I will preface it by saying, I do understand that many are not in this position. I guess I'm saying that find a way to push yourself into this position. Like I was saying, to create that story of who you are. But I think that the best way to avoid all of this, and how I have approached any deal that I have ever done against a behemoth corporation, whether that is Macmillan or anything else, I think that it is always a mistake to look at the deal itself as your savior, to look at it like something that is going to sweep you off your feet and, oh, I'm so lucky to have gotten this opportunity, and you're going to take me away and make me a big star. I think that anytime you approach someone like this, you should be coming at it from an even negotiating thing. And if you're not there yet, whether that is a internal confidence or a literal numbers of what you're selling in your self-published things, I think that it's a very easy way to be taken advantage of. The example that I always use, honestly, is the show American Idol, hit show where the prize was to get a record deal. No discussion of what kind of record deal, what the terms were, anything. And they were competing against this just to get that mentality is so pervasive.
Yes.
And really, anytime that these deals come up, I would hope that artists realize, you know, you need to be coming at this as an equal partner, saying, how are we going to make each other better? That's what you're looking for. It is not a lotto ticket.
Yep, exactly. And that's the exact issue with how I approached things when I was coming into the industry with that first offer, right? I did absolutely think of that deal as a lotto ticket, and that was the exact wrong way to approach it. So perfectly put.
But I'm curious, if you feel like answering, what deal did you get with Tor?
Okay, so this is what I love about this dang podcast. You buckaroos, dive in. Okay, so my first deal, I want to try to put it in terms of the modest terms of the Publisher's Weekly fake.
You can use
those
fake
things. I don't actually know what it is. What on this podcast? I think What do we think that the average deal that just kind of someone is, I mean, isn't it something like $3,000? It's not large at all, right? Or is it?
It's a, It's about, I think last I heard, it's about, for a big five in our genre, adult SFF and horror, it's like $7,000 to $25,000 per book for the kind of middle tier. And then I would say at least $75,000 to $100,000 per book for the kind of the bigger tiers.
For a debut. But
then I've heard in like romance and stuff, they're all over the map and in between. And in a historical, they routinely get six figures.
It's so funny because, you know, to discuss these numbers is always kind of funny because it is so dependent on like genre as well. There's like so much in there. Let's see. Okay. Based on those numbers, I would say that my first book deal was higher than the high end of that. But interestingly, and I think Buckaroos will find this interesting, to go with what I was saying, we did not go to auction, even though we could, because I wanted to be with Nightfire, because I liked them. So when they did that, you know, I had this book, and I think, you know, one strategy would be, well, let's talk to the others, and you kind of try to get them to bid against each other. And so I wanted to go with them because based on talking to them, they kind of understood what I was doing. We're going to have no problem with me self-publishing my erotica while I'm doing this, and like kind of understood how important that was to my expression. And it was a big enough deal. And basically what we got to negotiate with was I knew how much those books would make if I self-published them. So it didn't have to be like, okay, what does HarperCollins say versus Macmillan? It was, okay, Macmillan, I really like Nightfire. I've hung out with you all buckaroos and at, you know, dang Comic-Con, and I like your vision. So if you're going to offer me this, I'm going to tell you that I could make, you know, I think that I could calculate it that I would probably make like $30,000 or something per book if I published it. Self-published it. And sure. So, you know, it was kind of like, okay, I'm going to do that. So make it worth my time to, you know, do these other things. And so that was, you know, slightly larger than what you have said. And then in my four book deal, it is closer to what you described as the lead title thing. But to me too, a lot of the negotiations are, you know, I don't, this is going to sound wild, I don't actually care that much. What I care about for the number amount is how much, making sure that it is going to be a lead title, to which I would say is probably around, like, I'm guessing maybe to 50 to 100,000 per book. If that's the advance, then you know that's going to be the season's lead title, because that means that you're going to get a bunch of promotion behind it and stuff. And that's kind of why you would want to go with a big publisher anyway, is to have them helping you with your distribution and promotion. So as long as it's big enough in that range, you know, you start thinking, well, maybe someday I'll get a million per book. Like, I don't necessarily know if I would need that, because I always earn out. You know, I think Camp Damascus and Bear Your Gaze earned out on pre-orders. So I don't, you know, the size of the advance doesn't necessarily matter, because that's still just an advance on what you're going to make. To me, what matters is that's like a symbolic commitment to say, okay, we're going to put in this money and lock it in and say, yeah, that's how much we're going to spend on, you know, ads or promotion or press, or for me specifically putting me on tour, because my tours are slightly more expensive because I need Buckaroos to go with me to like get me from place to place. So it basically costs double for them to put me on tour. And I like to tour a lot. Like, I do a big show and everything when the books come out. An advance big enough that I know I would do that, because if I earn it out, then it just means it's going to take a year longer to actually get to me, basically.
Do you think tours sell books once? Like, the wisdom is that for debuts they don't, but I wondered if they do for more established authors, if they help.
Oh, you know, my gosh, do my tours sell books? Yes, okay. Absolutely. I mean, but I'm such a different monster in that sense than most authors. You know, like, you know, I did not tour the UK, but, you know, for Scott's reference, my Seattle show on this tour, we sold 512 tickets to my book event. And then people also buy multiple books. So I think we sold probably like 400 books just in the one stop in Seattle. So it's a little different because it's, you know, where most folks just show up and kind of read from the book or have a conversation. Generally, we like the bookstore to book me in like a theater. And then I do like a full show that's kind of like a one-man show kind of thing. And so that atmosphere does kind of drive sales. And then we also, there's things that they do where it's like you can buy, the ticket will get you into the show and it comes with a book. You know, which is, it counts as a sale. I prefer to just do cheaper tickets to shows, and then folks like what they see and they feel like a part of the community, and then they want to buy a book. So I don't, if it was up to me, it would just be a cheap show and then you can buy a book when you're there. But a lot of bookstores like to do it the other way. And then honestly, a big part of me signing this next deal for these four books was the guarantee of, okay, the touring thing, you know, we're doing this like a show. We need to, you know, are you going to let us kind of step this up in a way with how we sell the tickets and do it more like you would of like a theater tour or like a music tour and stuff. So, and they're on board. So it's kind of like I'm coming at this from a different way. But to answer your questions, yes, for me in particular, they really sell books to the point where I think when my books come out every summer for things like, you know, New York Times or things like that, bestseller lists, I'm probably going to do 7 shows in a row on that first week because I sell so many books, because it can kind of automatically just put me on a high up on a dang list.
I really think they need to revamp how they do events for authors. They're figuring that out in the UK. Like when we were doing the ICE and stuff, and I've noticed now that Waterstones is running a lot of like multiple author events where you come and there's other things going on and there's like entertainment, and it really does work. Like if it's an interesting evening, people will come out. I hate the idea of doing a traditional tour, but I would, I'd do something fun.
Oh, yes. I would never, you know, I started this way, and I think it's because, like I said, I don't come from the publishing industry. So a lot of these things that are kind of assumed, I don't start with any assumptions because I don't even know what they are. And so doing the tours was one of them. And I just thought, okay, so I'm supposed to go here and I'm supposed to read a section of this book that no one's read and then answer questions to spoil the book they're about to buy and read. It is just an absurd premise that this is how we've set up how authors do things. So from day one, I just kind of fully rejected it and kind of came up with my own version of it. I don't know why. It's always a huge show in Seattle. So Scott, next summer, you're on the dang guest list. You're coming.
I appreciate that. I don't know how much of this I want to make it into the show, but I have personal health concerns that have limited my public participation the last 5 going on 5 years.
Wow. Okay. Well, I if I can see you there, then I hope that I could.
I would love if you drop me a line regardless.
Yes.
And it's really personal. You can obviously not answer it. What your family think of your kind of life and career?
Well, I will start off by saying, you know, I have a very, I used to post much more in a way that I would say is symbolic. Like it's kind of, this is an honest expression of myself, but for my privacy, I was shrouded in metaphor. So there's things I will say about my family that actually represent something else. The best example I could give, I always say, you know, if I tweet, or I guess if I X or skeet now, that I pet a cat, I pet a dog, right? It's like, I kind of always like shift what's going on and kind of use a sort of, to speak of the art outside of the art, kind of have a lot of like symbols that if I'm feeling a certain way about death or aging or these different things, I'll post about it, but I kind of hide it in this, the kind of layer. Yeah, exactly. Lonesome, that's a perfect train example. And I will hide that. Although funny enough, the Lonesome Train is fully a real thing. It is a train that passes by at night. But yes, I can use that as a metaphor to talk about death and all these different things. So I do have all of those. And, but in the very real sense, I can say that, my family did not know about this for a very long time, and that on a recent tour, I said, hey, get the whole family together and come down to this show. I'm not going to tell you what it is. And just why don't you go? I'm going to get y'all dang tickets and see what happens. And they came and sat in the audience of the book tour, and it was a big old thing. And I think what's funny is because, you know, I am bi and also in a hetero presenting relationship. And after the show, I thought, I said to my manager, wow, what a way to come out to your family. I did not even realize what I was doing. But yeah, they said, okay, I did not know what that was going to be. And that's kind of how I revealed everything. And then to answer your question about the evangelical stuff, which I will, you know, be honest about, and it is a compliment, I will take it to my writing. I actually really do not have a history in that. That world is not something. Okay. The way that I worked on that on Camp Damascus was, you know, I did travel a lot in my youth, and a big portion of my youth was staying with and becoming very close with some very religious buckaroos. And so, you know, and this was at the time where there were examples in that book. It was kind of about that age of like, you know, I went to some root beer keggers when everyone happened to be of drinking age, one where the police literally broke it up. And said, okay, you know, we're going to arrest some of you. And then everyone said, no, that's just root beer. And they did not believe, they said, there is no way you're all getting arrested. And we said, no, have a cup. And it was root beer. So there are certain things kind of from that community where I had very good close friends in this community that served as a big inspiration. And then I also, as an older buckaroo, have a very close bud who was in a cult, like more than just, you know, however we want to define some of these larger religions as potential cults or however you want to say. But I mean a cult as in like a limited members, you would watch a documentary on Netflix about it kind of cult that actually some folks kind of know of. And so I did a few very long like interviews with them and recorded them. So that is actually kind of where that came from. And I would say that if like the thing that's more a book written from my experience and like what is the most kind of personal and revealing thing I've written is probably actually Bury Your Gaze. That's where I have thought, wow, I am really exposing myself here. And, you know, you got to for art. Camp Damascus, I think, exposed my relationship with autism, but Bury Your Gaze kind of is more closer to my life.
I'm going to have to read that one now.
I have just one question that goes way back to your story of how, you know, you got your trad deal, and it's a nuts and bolts of the industry kind of question. So you said that the tour or Nightfire, doesn't matter, I think it's the same person, account tweeted back at you, and that's how the whole thing started. I'm curious who emailed you after that and whether they became your editor.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, this is actually very nice. I will go into this slight. The whole, gosh, there's so much wonderful, beautiful serendipity. So when I was self-published, I would go to Comic-Con all the time, just because Buckaroos kind of knew who I was. I'd fly down and generally Troma, who is an indie, I think, and I use this endearingly, I don't even say this, but they would probably say like a trashy indie kind of horror and like sexploitation kind of silly film company. They did Toxic Avenger and stuff. Wonderful buckaroos would always bring me down and say, oh, Chuck, why don't you just hang out at the Troma booth? Because I have a unusual presentation and they make unusual movies. So I would always go down and kind of like trot around the booth with them, be on a couple of panels. And while I was down there, I walked by the tour booth. And they would wave and say, Chuck, because, you know, I was in, you know, publishing. And there was a buckaroo named Laura there. And we kind of like started talking. And so I just knew Laura at Tor. Flash forward to me posting that. And I can't remember if it was Laura. I think it was someone other than Laura, but they essentially forwarded it to Kelly, who is my editor at Nightfire, who is amazing and wonderful. Yeah. And I believe Kelly messaged me, and Laura became my press person. So the Laura, who I kind of met at the booth many years before and who we kind of knew, now does all my like publicity stuff. And then Kelly is my editor. And honestly, the other thing that's nice about Tor is they kind of just, you know, they let me do kind of whatever I want. I think that it is because, you know, there are authors that you could sign that, like, you know, oh, we're going to get this adaption deal and they're going to do this. They're very kind of like utilitarian in what they do. And I think that's a great thing. There's a lot of directors like this too. It's like a really wonderful, it's a very good career and an important skill set to have. I think that with someone like me, because it's my sensibilities are so unique, they're not like going to spend a bunch of money for Chuck Tingle and then not want a Chuck Tingle book. So when it comes to my editing, they kind of just, you know, Kelly's a very good editor in that she kind of lets me do my thing. I don't think there's ever been a note that I haven't been, you know, I don't get many notes, and the ones that I do get, I am always, especially with Kelly, like, that's genius.
Yeah.
Like that is what it should be. So, they very much respect.
Yeah. That was just an interesting story to me because, you know, obviously the people behind a social media account, I actually don't know if she's behind the social media account anymore, but, the person who was has always been incredible. Just a wonderful, kind person. But
do you know who it is? I might know that. Who's the one running it? I can't remember.
It used to be Rachel.
Oh, it is Rachel. Rachel's the best. Rachel, I think, still does it.
So nice. Yeah. Well, she got a promotion recently, so I didn't know if, you know, that.
Oh, you're right. You know, it could have changed. I don't know. All these buckaroos, like, there's a whole dozen of them I've been there long enough that they start getting promoted and stuff. And so I'm always like, oh, I come back and I guess you're the vice president now or something. It's just such a silly, it's really wonderful. Yeah. And that's honestly with Nightfire too. That's the reason that I wanted to sign the next, like I said, I didn't go to anyone else. I didn't want an auction. I basically said, okay, you know, as long as it's enough that it's going to be the lead, because I will, you know, I'll make back the advance. I kind of just want to be here because I like that there's like just kind of a really nice family kind of thing. I've been there for years. I know everybody, and it's, you know, there's a personal thing there. Yeah. So that's really wonderful. I think what's funny, speaking of my arrogance, my inflated world's greatest author ego, but it is funny because I do remember in the negotiations specifically being like, well, the one thing that I'm going to negotiate with is, you know, obviously we want less books in our deal. Because if I get less books, then as I become even bigger with every consecutive book, then we will make more on the next ones. And I think that it was very funny talking to other authors who seem to be kind of the, like we said, in the lotto ticket mindset of, oh, you don't want more books on your deal? And I thought, no, I want them to have to pay more as I explode into the stratosphere and renegotiate.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, you're just assuming that. And I said, oh, yes, I am, buckaroo. So, you know, that it's a very funny like mentality, I think, that many, many folks have in the face of these behemoth corporations. The other thing that's funny, so I have to kind of disguise my voice because I've done interviews without the mask under my legal name. So I kind of have to kind of like change it slightly. And so folks always think, oh, okay, well, then you must not really like use all those words like buckaroo. And I just think, if only you knew my friends and how often I'll text someone and say, hey, buckaroo, you want to go for a morning trot? And they say, oh, I thought that was just the Chuck thing. I say, no, the boundaries between me and Chuck have fully melted away at this point. It's just one and the same.
Oh, no, it's right. I was just curious. So I thought I'd ask, but yeah. I mean, if you're all right with it, Scott, I was going to take the time to ask you, Chuck, if there is a petty hill that you would die on, because I always enjoy hearing about those from authors.
Oh, no, there was the petty hill. I got this. You know, the problem is that I am like, I am known for my positive takes online, and it's almost like I have really dedicated myself to not having petty hills, and I genuinely okay. don't, but it's almost like the opposite. Well, it's like the opposite of a petty hill, which is this. It does bother me, and this isn't quite a petty hill, but like the idea of a guilty pleasure. I have really tried to eliminate that because I think the art that I make is kind of a rejection of the difference between like high and low brow. And so I just think that there is pleasures. And so it's almost like I very much in my life tried to eliminate the idea that something is a guilty pleasure, or that I am like doing something ironically. I really want sincerity. And so I think my petty hill is that, because it's fine. You know, we can talk, we can all live our own lives how we want, be as ironic as we want. It's totally fine. But for me, I just always think, no, that's just a pleasure. There is no such thing as a guilty pleasure.
I love that.
That is awesome. Actually, I love it. Thank you. I mean, I'm happy with that. If there's anything else you want to kind of throw in or disagree, feel free, but otherwise I'm cool with that.
We've disagreed enough. Oh my gosh, I am so thankful to come on, and I opened with this, and I would be remiss to not close with the fact that, you know, there is this podcast. My agent actually has Writing Excuses, yes. Which is another great.
That.
Yeah, that's actually a very good resource, especially because it's all like, I think there's some writers, but they're like very like kind of like established, like many years and a lot and of agents. So that's very helpful.
Dongwon,
my agent. So Dongwon's the best. So yeah, that is a big recommendation. And then there is a book that I got because I think you mentioned it. Is it like after the
book? That's right. Before and after the book deal. Courtney Mom.
Before. There you go. So that's also another good one, but it's just, it is astonishing how little this is. We talked about the lotto ticket thing, and it's almost like I talk about it. I literally say this. People think that it's a lotto ticket, like your chances of being a successful artist, but really it's actually two. It's like you have to win the lotto to then enter the second lotto that is just as difficult as the first one, where oh great, I'm here and I get my ticket in the form of a book, and then I have to win the lotto again to make a career out of it. And so if you think about that, it's like the audience for these things has to already have won that first lotto ticket. It is tiny. And so like the heart and the love and the care and the service, do not think there is any amount that I could say to really show like, and I don't even know if the listeners realize this. That's why I think I want to drive this point home is like, just if you're out there listening, know that, like, you know, the audience for this is you. There is not that many resources.
I do feel really embarrassed now, but thank you.
Oh no!
Sorry, being embarrassed is my life.
Well, you know, can I attach this to what we said? I will say, you know, sometimes we think like, what's that story outside of the story? This podcast for the two of you kind of is that. Yeah. You know what I mean? It is an interesting thing where it's like, we never know where what that's going to be, how the art is going to reach out. But now, you know, I would say if, but it'll be when, because, you know, I am such a big fan, you know, reading your books, you know, art is going to be colored by this. There's going to be people who find it from there. It's, I don't know. It's like, you are giving everyone a gift. And I just want to say,
thank you, Chuck.
thanks, Chuck.
Yes.
I've got to ask you to plug yourself as well on the off chance that some people don't know where to find your books or you.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, I am on pretty much every social media, but right now, Blue Sky is tickling my fancy.
Like Blue Sky.
And it's all, yeah, it's pretty great. And it's all, it's just at Chuck Tingle. You can kind of find me anywhere. Barrier Gaze is out now. And then summer, you know, I'm going to basically, I'm going to have a new queer horror novel out every summer for the next 4 years, 5 years now. No, 4 years. Awesome. Yeah, because this is the first book of my next four. And so each year I'll be doing that. And then this next one's a book called Lucky Day that you can pre-order. And pre-orders are a very big deal. I hope everyone knows that. I think that video games, I have heard, give pre-orders a pretty bad name because they put books up for, or games up for pre-order that aren't finished. Books, pre-orders are that you know, tells bookstores how much shelf space to dedicate, that tells your publisher how much ad revenue and like press. So if you are a fan
You've
of a book,
been listening to the Publishing Radio Podcast with Sunny Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more really in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of some of those points, actually, especially with regards to shelf space.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's across the board. It's all dang pre-orders.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. I will hit stop there if that's all right.